Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. If you have just joined us, welcome to Radio Islam International. Welcome to the program Family Health Matters. I'm your hostess, Nazinet. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Well, first up is health news. And in health news today, we're just looking at something very quick. It's what does sugar, or you know, what sugar does to your brain, rather. And that will be followed by early childhood intervention. And for this program, we're going to be joined by the Lanesha Clinic's community-based rehabilitation team, the CBR. We have with us Raisa Mullah, who is the speech therapist and audiologist, Trish Ventura, who is the community service physiotherapist, and Kendall Creary, the community service occupational therapist. Now, inshallah, that's going to be the next part of our program. But for now, let's do the health news first. You know, what does sugar really do to our brains? We don't really think about it, but it really impacts on your brain. So let's see. They say the brain uses more energy than any other organ in the human body, and the glucose is its source of fuel. But what happens when the brain is exposed to the excessive amount of sugars in, you know, just the standard diet? Now, in this case, more is definitely not better. In the brain, excess sugar impairs both our cognitive skills and our self-control. That is, having a little sugar stimulates a craving for more. Sugar has drug-like effects in the reward center of the brain. And scientists have proposed that sweet foods, along with salty and fatty foods, can produce addiction-like effects in the human brain, driving loss of self-control, overeating, and subsequent weight gain. Now, in early humans, this stimulus helped lead them to calorie-rich foods, which aided survival when food was scarce. But now, this primitive drive contributes to our epidemics of obesity and diabetes. The behavioral and neurobiochemical characteristics of substance abuse and overeating are quite similar, and the idea of food addiction is gaining ground among scientists. Now, in humans, high glycemic foods have been found to activate regions of the brain associated with the reward response and provoke more intense feelings of hunger compared to low glycemic foods. And foods that cause a higher elevation in blood glucose produce a greater addictive drive in the brain. And studies on brain activity have provided evidence supporting the idea that overeating alters our brain's reward system, which then further drives overeating. Now, this same process is thought to underlie the tolerance associated with addiction. Over time, greater amounts of the substance are required to reach the same level of reward, and studies imply that overeating results in diminished reward response and a progressively worsening addiction to low nutrient foods rich in sugar, salt, and in fat. Throughout the body, excess sugar is harmful. Even a single instance of elevated glucose in the bloodstream can be harmful to the brain, resulting in slowed cognitive function and deficit in memory and attention. Sugar also affects mood. In healthy young people, the ability to process emotion is compromised with elevated blood glucose, according to a recent brain imaging study. And another study found that type 2 diabetics increased feelings of sadness and anxiety during acute hypoglycemia, that is the elevated blood sugar. Now, looking at elevated glucose in your brain, it says that elevated blood glucose harms blood vessels. Blood vessels damage is a major cause of the vascular complications of diabetes, leading to other problems, such as damage to blood vessels in the brain and the eyes, causing retinopathy. Now, studies of long-term diabetics show progressive brain damage leading to deficits in learning, memory, motor speed, and other cognitive functions. Frequent exposure to high glucose levels diminished mental capacity, as higher HbA1c levels have been associated with a greater degree of brain shrinkage. Even in those without diabetes, higher sugar consumption is associated with lower scores on tests of cognitive function. Now, these effects are thought to be due to a combination of hyperglycemia, hypertension, insulin resistance, and elevated cholesterol. So basically, any sugar added in our food is dangerous. We can avoid these dangers by satisfying our sweet tooth with fresh fruit in place of refined sugars and other concentrated sweeteners such as honey and maple syrup are equally dangerous. I think honey is when you take too much of honey. By eating fresh fruit, we get the satisfying sweetness and the added bonus of the fruit's fiber, antioxidants, and phytochemicals that curtail the surge of sugar in the bloodstream and block its negative effects. So here's something for us to think about. We should try, especially with our little ones, I think we should try cutting that sugar off from a very young age so that it doesn't become something that they have to have. And we notice this with children. If you don't give them sweets and they want that sweets, they, you know, it's like really like they're addicted to it. They need something sweet. So inshallah, I hope this will be of some benefit to our listeners out there. Well, that's it. We'll take a break now. And when we return, we're going to be talking to our team that's with us in the studio. That's the Lanesha Clinics Community-Based Rehabilitation Team. Inshallah, stay tuned. We'll be back in a few moments. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to the program Family Health Matters. I'm your sister Zenith, and joining me this afternoon in our studios, it's the Lanesha Clinics Community-Based Rehabilitation Team, the CBR. It's Raisa Mulla, who is a speech therapist and audiologist, Trish Ventura, who is the community service physiotherapist, and Kendall Creary, the community service occupational therapist. We're going to be talking about early childhood intervention. Now, a reminder to our listeners that our lines will be open. If perhaps you have any questions or concerns, please do feel free to contact us. The number to dial 011-854-1548. We also have an SMS or WhatsApp number, which is 082-84-92786. So, yes, today we're going to be looking at, like I said, early childhood intervention. We'll be looking at the importance of it, the development milestones, and its importance in relation to childhood intervention. We also want to look at how speech therapy, physiotherapy, occupational therapy can assist children in early childhood. And then also risk factors and warning signs. I hope we can cover all of this today, but inshallah, I'm sure we have a lot to speak to you about. And of course, we'd like to end off with some good tips for parents on how to stimulate your child, inshallah. So, assalamu alaikum. Good afternoon to both of you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, let's start off with early childhood intervention. Rishna, what is early childhood intervention and why is it so important?
Okay, so intervention is the process of providing specialized support and services for infants and young children with developmental delays or disabilities. It also assists the family to promote development, well-being, and community participation. So it looks at a child from a young age, and that's where we come in. So we are quite focused on early childhood intervention. So the sooner you come in, the better it is for us in terms of intervention services. So early childhood intervention services support children with disabilities or developmental delays from birth to school level entry, as well as assisting their families. So it provides therapy and or education, counseling, service planning and coordination. We provide assistance and support to access services such as schools, etc. So services are tailored to meet the individual needs of the child and focused on supporting the child in their natural environment and their everyday experiences and activities. The overall aim of these services is to provide parents and families with the knowledge, skills, and support to meet the needs of their child and to optimize the child's community life. Services are provided using a family-centered approach, recognizing the importance of working in partnership with the family. So, at the clinics, we focus quite largely on ECI services. So we did mention previously that we do go to the Civic Center in Lanesha. So we'd look at kids from a young age where we'd screen them and we'd see if there's anything that, any services that need to be provided to the children. So it focuses a lot on that early intervention. So as soon as possible that that intervention is needed, that's when your ECI services would come in. Okay. So the early childhood years are just as important for children with disabilities and developmental delays as they are for all children. So all their future development is based on the critical learning patterns that are laid down during this period. That's why we say the earlier the better. The earlier are also critical for the whole family, so this is when the families can best begin to learn how to support and nurture their child, how to meet their child's needs, how to adapt positively to having a child with disability or developmental delay. So ECI looks at the child holistically, so you're looking at a whole lot of different factors at how you can assist them. So you want to help the family to achieve their goals and hopes for their child, support their child to further develop skills and abilities to participate and enjoy daily life, extend the experiences which the family can provide to support their child's growth and development. So ECI services could include just providing information to parents. So that's where we'd come in as well, so giving talks, something like this, so speaking on the radio so that parents are aware of what is early childhood intervention, why is it important. So we'd also do an assessment. Specialized intervention support could be therapy or specialized education. We could develop individualized programs specifically for the child, so targeting their difficulties and what assistance does the child need and the family needs. We'd assist with participating in school, whether it be preschool or if we have to refer them out to maybe the Department of Education. We could also give prescription of equipment that could be possibly a hearing aid to a child or if a child needs pediatric crutches, those kind of things. And we look at supporting and transitioning to an educational setting, so getting them into schooling. So it's a broad range of things that focuses on the child as soon as possible, basically.
Yeah, there's one thing I just wanted to ask you about is that this kind of intervention, this early childhood intervention, I think you mentioned it, but just for the benefit of our listeners, mm-hmm. it's not only for children that have developmental problems or that has some kind of a problem. It's for our normal children too. If there's anything, you know, you can actually help them as well.
See, even if a child doesn't have a diagnosis, so they're not diagnosed with maybe autism or cerebral palsy, but they possibly have maybe a language delay or they're not walking when they're supposed to be walking, but everything else is fine, then they still need possibly some form of early intervention. So it doesn't just look at the child with a disability or a developmental delay. It looks at all children as a whole. So it looks at each child, and that's when we're going to go into risk factors where parents can pick up on these things and see if there's anything that they need help with.
Yeah, no, it's alhamdulillah, it's wonderful to know because, you know, unfortunately, sometimes we leave it for too late. And if you had picked it up earlier, you could have done so much and helped the child so much.
Yeah.
And parents, I think, should be aware of this, that, you know, there's a lot of help out there. All you need to do, I mean, if you're going taking your child to the clinic, you can talk to the nurses out there. If you're coming, and they can obviously refer you. And if you, like you say, you come there at on a regular basis, and mm-hmm. you can also pick these things up.
Yeah.
So parents should not be scared to say, I think something is wrong with my child. And I think sometimes, you know, we I don't know what it is. We just don't want to know that there's something wrong with the child.
I think sometimes parents are often in denial, sort of. So they think like, oh no, let's just wait a little bit. Or my previous child did this a little bit later. They often compare the kids to each other. But if you are worried about something, it doesn't hurt to get help. So even if you're speaking to maybe your doctor, you're going for a normal checkup, or like you said at the clinic, the nurses, just mention it, you might need some form of intervention. It might not be necessary from us. It might be further referrals to the hospital or maybe assistance with schooling. So ask. And then obviously the more you ask, the more information you're going to get, and the better it is for you as a parent.
Mm-hmm. And especially for the child.
The
most important thing. Okay, so what is a developmental milestone, and you know, what importance does it play in relation to early childhood intervention?
Okay, so when you're talking about developmental milestones, it's the ability that is achieved by most children at a certain age. So developmental milestones can include your physical, social, emotional, cognitive, communication skills, also your physical abilities. So there's different things that we look at. So it's important to know that children do grow and develop at different rates. However, most children do pass through these certain developmental skills or things that we're looking out for. So for an example would be a child is babbling single syllables at 4 to 6 months. As they're getting a little bit older, we'd see multiple syllables. And then by the time they're 2 years old, they have two-word sentences. So it's little steps the child has to achieve in order for the next step to occur. So, however, just keep in mind that children vary in their development, and one child might develop a little bit differently from another. So often we have parents come in and they're like, no, but my son, he was 12 months and he was already putting, he was already saying a few words. But now this child is not saying anything. So parents often compare, it's human nature, but we often do encourage parents, we understand you have somebody that you are, you know, looking against, the current child that you have, but we try and tell parents that each child is developing differently. So let that child develop at their rate. There might be a delay, there might not be a delay. The child might just be taking a little bit longer compared to their sibling to be doing something else. So it's almost like it's a checklist. Mm. So it represents what an average child does at that specific point in time. But you have to be a bit flexible when it comes to developmental milestones. But it just gives you a better idea of, okay, my child is maybe 14 months, they're not walking. Okay, let's wait a few months, maybe now they're 15, 16 months and they're still not walking. So it just gives you an idea, okay, they were supposed to be doing this, I gave them a little bit of time, but they're still not doing it. Now, okay, let's start, get the ball rolling with maybe physio.
Mm. Yeah, it's very important, and you know, especially if you have children one after the other, and sometimes, you know, by the third child, they pick up even faster because they've already learning from the others.
Yeah.
So, but it's important, like you say, never to, compare these children to each other. Everyone develops at his own pace.
Yeah.
But you need to keep it, like you say, this checklist is very important.
Yeah.
Don't forget about it and don't neglect it.
See,
and think, okay, this one is going to do this at this time. And you know, just overlook things.
See,
we need to be, very aware
observant
and observant
well.
Where our children are concerned.
If parents have the Road to Health book, on page 13, there is a checklist on there. So it's broken up into specific ages from the child is born. I think it goes up till 6 years old, if I'm not mistaken. And it looks at communication, physical development, as well as their cognitive development. So it's a quick summary. So if you're not sure, and if you do have the Road to Health book, maybe you don't have access to the internet, it is in that book as well. So you can check.
Mm.
But everything is easily accessible online as well. So if you are concerned, just type in your child's age, type in developmental milestones, and have a read. Don't necessarily trust everything that you're reading, but if you are reading something, then maybe the next time you go to your doctor or the nurse, you can be like, I read this, I'm not too sure, could you possibly assist me with some advice?
Yeah, no, definitely. It's very important for you as a parent to be observant at all times. Trish, can you provide milestones a child has to reach in terms of, okay, the speech therapist, occupational therapy, physiotherapy, etc.? Or shall we just take you all one by one?
Yeah, so I'm just going to cover the physio part.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. So we're looking at like the main muscle groups that do like big activities. So a child from 0 to 6 months will usually bear weight on their legs when they're supported, and they can roll from their stomach to their back and from their back to their stomach. And when they're helped up from lying to sitting, then their head is usually steady, it doesn't fall back. And when on the stomach, they can push up on their hands, they can also lift their head and look about. And they can also sit with support. From about 6 to 12 months, they should be able to stand while their mother or father or an adult holds onto their hands. They can lift their head up while lying on their back. They begin like attempts to crawl. They can play with toys while in sitting. They stand usually holding onto furniture. They can pull up into a standing position, and that's usually with furniture. And they walk holding onto a hand or onto furniture. And when they get usually to about 12 to 18 months, they're able to sit, crawl, and walk. They will still have a wide stance when they're walking or running, but it will be a little less clumsy from when they first began to walk or run. They can get to a standing position alone, and they can seat themselves in a chair. At 18 to 24 months, a child should be able to run, although it's usually quite stiffly. They can walk up and down stairs if they have a hand that's held. They can hurl a ball. They can kick a ball or an object. They will jump with both feet. They can stand on one foot with one hand held. They can kick a ball forward, and they can pick up toys from the floor without falling over. And then from 24 to 30 months, a child can walk upstairs without their hands held. They can jump from the bottom step down to the floor. They can throw a ball, and they can approximately walk on a line. And then from 30 to 36 months, they can balance on one foot for about several seconds. They can walk backwards, and they can walk up and down the stairs, alternating their feet. And they usually catch with their body, like their chest.
You know, there's one thing that I wanted to know while we are talking about these milestones. Is it possible for children to actually miss out on some of these milestones? An example would be, and I noticed that happens, it's a bit common, or it does happen now and again, where a child would miss out, say, perhaps the crawling part. Is it a good thing, or should a child then rather be encouraged to crawl?
So with crawling, there are certain benefits for a child. So when a child comes to us and we're seeing that they are a little bit delayed, and parents go, oh no, but he started walking, let's just go with that and miss the crawling. We like to advise that the crawling does happen because there are benefits for a child to be horizontal and first, then going to vertical. So the benefits would be stability in the arms and shoulders, as well as the trunk and tummy. So by crawling, they have a little bit more stability, and they are holding themselves up. So when they move to standing, they have correct postures. As well as when they're crawling, they can hold their head up against gravity. And then when they move to standing, they have a more stable tummy and back, so that they don't have incorrect postures or more arches or things that will then affect their walking and running as they grow. Things like improving the strength of their arms will then benefit them as they grow older. There's no delay for things like when they start writing or when they start trying to climb things. Their arms aren't weak. And that all starts from a few months old when they learn to crawl. So we try to, some milestones are smaller and less significant, but something like crawling we think is very, very important to try and encourage our children to do. But obviously if your child is 4 years old and they didn't crawl and they went straight to walking, bringing them to us and saying, okay, now we have to make your child crawl, it's not going to be appropriate. So we want to try and reach that crawling milestone at the right age.
At the right time too. Okay, no, because I know there are some people that prefer the child not crawling because of, you know, not getting dirty. We have some of those people that actually think that, at least my child is not going to be getting dirty and the clothes will stay clean, their knees will stay clean and white. So if they miss it, it's fine. But actually, it is important for that child to go through that phase, the crawling phase.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we return, inshallah, we continue with our program. A reminder to our listeners, if you do have any questions or concerns, please do feel free to contact us. The number to dial is 011-854-1548. You can also SMS or WhatsApp me on the number 082-84-92-786. We have with us the Lanesha Clinic's community-based rehabilitation team. That is Raisa Mulla, who is a speech therapist and audiologist, Trish Ventura, who is a physiotherapist, and Kendall Creary, who is our occupational therapist. So if you have questions, please do feel free to contact us. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a few moments. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back to Family Health Matters. I'm your sister Zeenat, and my guests is Raisa Mulla, Trish Ventura, and Kendall Creary, the audiologist and speech therapist, physiotherapist, and occupational therapist. Thank you so much once again for joining us in the studio today, and we're talking about early childhood intervention. Now, let's continue with our program, and we're going to be looking at the occupational therapist now. You know, Kendall, what milestones should be reached, you know, up to about 3 years?
So Trish did say a lot of the physical things, which OTs look at as well, but we also look at activities that the children should be doing. At the younger ages, we just want, like, 3 months, we want them to be smiling. Trish did say things about lifting the head and focusing on objects. 6 months, she spoke about the rolling and sitting with support, but we also want the child to be drinking from a bottle with both hands, playing with toys with both hands. This is because they have not yet developed a dominant hand at this age. So that's something to always look out for and encourage. At 9 months, we're still looking at pulling to standing and cruising, which is the holding on furniture. Trish also mentioned that. And then there's the rest she spoke about, but I want to look more at children at about 18 months should be able to follow simple instructions. At 2 years, they should start to know their body parts, and if you give them a crayon to start spontaneously scribbling, this then at 3 years old will turn into learning to draw basic shapes, stick men, and copy things that you draw as well. And they should also start to help dress themselves at 3 years old. Another thing we look at is play development. So from 0 to 1 year old, we want the babies to be doing a lot of sensory motor play, which includes exploring the environment, things, feeling different textures, teddy bears, rattles, things that make noise, banging things, exploring noises, smells, sounds. Bright colored toys attract them, and that then encourages them to move, encourages them to crawl, encourages them to walk. And as they get a bit older, we start functional play. So then we look at them zipping up and down zips and opening containers and closing them, opening cupboards, closing them. And then by 3 years old, they're starting to do a little bit more pretend, and they start to get an imagination, pretending to drink from a cup. So they know the function of the cup, and then they can take it and make a pretend scenario that there's no juice in that cup, but they can pretend, or feed a teddy bear, those types of things.
Mm. It's interesting, you know, if you sit and look at it. Every little thing a child does is supposed to be what he or she has to do at that particular time. It's really amazing. And it's amazing how children grow up and learn all the time. Okay, Raisa, as a speech therapist and audiologist.
Okay. So, speech therapy and audiology, I'm going to go into a little bit detail about it.
Yes,
as well.
I think many parents are very concerned about this particular. You know, if a child don't talk, then there's a problem quickly. And, you know, you always tend to, like you say, you know, compare them to the other children.
See.
So let's see how children are supposed to be developing.
Okay, so from 0 to 6 months, the it's already from such a young age, so your baby starts reacting to loud sounds with a startle. So that could be like a door banging, or they hear a loud noise, so they quickly jump up. They react initially to sounds that are closer to them, but as they develop a little bit more, then it would be distant sounds. By the end of the third month, a child recognizes their mother's voice. They make different kinds of crying for hunger, pain, etc. They attend to the speaker's mouth and eyes. They turn their head or eyes to search for sounds, and they respond to voices by babbling. Okay. By 6 to 12 months old, they start responding to their name. They turn their eye, head, and body to the source of the sound, and they begin changing babbling to real words. So they'd start with ba ba ba, ma ma ma, and then by the time they're 12 months old, you get a real word. So the real first word would be something like mama or dada. Then by 12 to 18 months, they listen to simple stories, songs, and rhymes. They can follow one-step commands without any assistance, and they can give objects if asked. By 18 to 24 months, so they understand when they're being called from another room, they can assist with, they can do sequencing, but obviously very basic because they are still a little bit younger. And then by the time they are 2 years old, they should be about 25% to 50% intelligible with their speech. Then 24 to 30 months, if you're reading a storybook to them, they'll ask you questions about it. 60% of speech is intelligible by 30 months. They'd start putting words together. So it won't just be something like mama at this point. They'd go, daddy go, or I want, doggy woof woof. So they start joining words together. So that's a milestone that you'd look out for. And then by 3 years old, their intelligibility would increase a lot more. So they'd start producing a little bit more sentences, so the sentences are getting a little bit longer, they're putting three words together, speech is a little bit more clear. So they master adult-like speech. So, you know, we mentioned the milestones, so they start with simple and it gets more complex as they grow up. Mm-hmm. For all of us.
Alhamdulillah. Now, Trish, can you perhaps provide us with some of these risk factors, or rather warning signs, that parents can look out for?
I'm just going to mention a few, but mainly regarding the, like I said, the big movements.
Okay.
So if a child does not reach for or grasp or hold any objects by 3 or 4 months, if they don't roll over in either direction by 5 months, if they can't sit up with any help or any support by 6 months, if they don't actively reach for objects by 7 months, if they can't crawl or can't stand without being supported by the age of one, if they can't walk or push a wheel toy, like a wheelbarrow, for example, by 18 months, and if they still walk on their toes by the age of two.
So those would be some of the things that one should be a bit concerned about?
Yeah, it's just a guideline, and it just focuses on the big, broad movements a child will do.
Mm-hmm. Kendall?
So,
as an occupational therapist, what are you going to be looking out for?
So the red flags that we want to make sure parents know your children's milestones, and just watch them, that they're achieving them at the right age, and if they're a little bit here or there, late or early, then that's okay. It's just more or less a guideline. So firstly, milestones, reach them, that's a red flag if they're not reaching them within the 6 months. The other thing is when they're very small, to start using both hands, like I was saying, because that hand dominance only comes when they're much older, 4 or 5 years old, or, you know, sometimes a little bit earlier, but starting to scribble and things like that, that's when they learn hand dominance. So always using both hands equally in play. And then noting your child's movements, that they are asymmetrical. So if they are using one hand all the time, if one side of the body seems more floppy or more stiff, or maybe just one limb, one leg, one arm, seems more floppy or stiff than the others. And the both sides of the body, as in a baby, should be moving in the same way. They should be reaching both hands out, grabbing both their toes, things like that. And always notice if your child seems maybe a little bit more floppy, or what we call low tone, or otherwise more stiff, which we call increased tone. It's when the muscles are very tight. Those are just some things to look out for.
Mm-hmm.
Also, parents just need to know that a child that is premature or born a little bit early, not full term, we're not too concerned if they are a few months or weeks delayed from reaching their milestones, because they should develop for their full term, the age they would be for their full term. So if the baby was born a month early, we would then say if he's not sitting by 7 months, not 6 months, that it's a problem. If that makes more sense.
Yeah, no, that certainly does, because it does. Parents do get very concerned, especially where babies are premature, and they want their children to be developing, and if they find that the child is not developing, I think the first thing you think that there's something really wrong with the child. Yet I think they catch up very much, as they grow up, they start catching up quickly, isn't it?
Yes, so they, at the beginning, just watch that if there's the time difference from their prematureness, that's the only concern, that just allow them that little bit of extra time to catch up with the others.
You know, another thing that I just wanted to know about, because I've noticed this, is sometimes babies, when they are born, they don't open up their hands very easily. You find some of the little hands opening up, but the other one would be staying stiff. Is that a concern? Is that something that must be seen to?
It depends on the age. So if I'm not mistaken, 6 months is when constant fisting of a hand is considered to be a problem. Babies are still learning to control their bodies. They don't know how movements work. They've just come out of a womb where they're sitting wrapped up tight and haven't had to move. So when they're very young, we don't see it as a concern. But as soon as they get a little bit older, where they should be reaching for objects and things, if the one hand is reaching and the other one isn't, then we might have a problem. If they're not using both of their hands equally and in the same way, we could have a problem. And I would say probably start getting concerned around 6 months.
Okay. So, Raisa, as a speech therapist and audiologist,
okay,
what
so
are the concerns?
So caregiver concern is a big one. So if you aren't sure if your child is developing appropriately, then please do seek some of intervention. So from an audio point of view, the sooner the intervention occurs, the much better it is for child. So you need to ask yourself, and you need to be very observant of certain things. So certain questions that you can ask yourself would be like, is my baby waking up if there's a loud noise? Is that startle reflex occurring? Do they calm if I talk to them? So if baby's crying and they hear mommy's voice, do they suddenly start getting calm? Do they respond to your voice either by smiling or you see some form of interaction from them? Do they turn their eyes towards the sound? Do they smile when they're spoken to? Do they notice rattles? Are they responding to their name? So those are things from an audio point of view. So if your child is not responding, you're calling them, you have to constantly repeat, or if you have to talk very, very loud to your child, or they're not following instructions, the first thing that we want to make sure is, are they hearing properly? Because if they do have hearing difficulties, then the sooner we fit them with either a hearing aid or any other form of assistive device for them, auditory system, the better it is for them in terms of learning oral language.
How soon can you as a parent actually find out whether your child can hear or not?
Okay, so you obviously notice these small things, but we can test a child's hearing ability from a very young age. Obviously, it's dependent on the age, so we do test differently for each age group. If you are concerned, then we can do a quick screening. So it's supposed to be done in the hospitals, but obviously due to lack of services and staff, they don't do a lot of neonatal screenings. So if you have a family history of hearing loss, then possibly get a quick screening done to see if your child needs a full hearing test or not. So like I mentioned before, it's dependent on age. So a baby can be tested for their hearing as soon as possible. We do the test differently. So if you have a baby that obviously can't tell you if they're hearing or not, what you do is you put the parent in the booth with the child, and while the mother is breastfeeding, we present the sound and we look for, is the child stop? Is there any reaction? Do they stop sucking? Do they quickly open their eyes wide? Does it look like they're looking for the sound? So you can take a baby in from quite an early age to do a hearing test. Jay. then from a speech point of view, you'd look at if they start mispronouncing speech, we give them a little bit of leeway because when they're 3 years old, they're supposed to be, their speech does get a little bit clearer. But if it's by 4 or 5 years old and the speech is not making a lot of sense, it's not very intelligible, then you should be concerned that there might be articulation or phonological process difficulty occurring. Then a child is still saying single words, so by 2 years old they're only saying mama. They're not putting two words together, then you could be concerned. They have very limited vocab. They're not pointing to objects in books. So if you tell them to show you something, they don't understand. If you tell them to name something, they can't tell you what the names of things are. Something that we often look out for is something called echolalia. So that's something that we see in autism. So that would be a child is repeating after the parent. So if mommy says something like, want milk, and the child says, want milk. So they're constantly repeating. So that would be a warning sign for autism. So that could be something as well. Then they're not following simple directions or understanding simple instructions. And they're not really developing their language each month that they grow. So you'd look at those kind of things.
Okay, and how do you all work together to treat a young child? Trish?
So a typical session with us would first involve getting a case history of the child. So it would involve us first asking about the mom's pregnancy, whether she carried to full term, was there any complications with the birthing process, labor or delivery. And we also want to know about the family's health and the child's current health status. And then we would also like to ask the mom what the child is able to do in terms of activities and how the child is able to move around. We'll also ask questions regarding how the child sleeps, feeds, plays with toys, how the child communicates either with people or the environment. And once we have got all that information, we'll then move on to our physical assessment, whereby we'll check whether the child has reached all the appropriate milestones for their age regarding the motor skills we discussed and the communication and speech skills.
So once again, it's important for you all to work together.
Yes.
And obviously get the most out of the child.
Yes.
Okay, I think it's just about almost time for us to wrap up, but Raisa, we end with you today, right?
Okay.
It's a very important question because I think many people want to know about this. As a speech therapist, what is your view on the use of pacifiers, as commonly known as our dummies?
Okay, so I'll give you some advantages and disadvantages and then you can have a better idea. Okay, so the advantages, you can use a dummy as a sleep aid. It can also assist the child in stressful situations. So maybe they're going for immunizations or doctor's visits, so the dummy is quite calming for them. It can also assist you by distinguishing between a hungry versus a fussy baby. So if a fussy baby turns away the dummy, he or she may be ready for another meal. However, you need to keep in mind that a fussy baby may be trying to communicate something else. So need to be held, need to be burped or be changed. It can also assist with reflux. So it's not a treatment for reflux, but the sucking action actually help keep the stomach fluid from rising up into the throat. So, yeah, so you can use that. And then for infants that are tube fed, using a dummy during tube feeds may increase the infant's association between oral movement and food intake, which is beneficial when they transition to eating via the mouth. So you still want to give a child that is being fed through the tube some form of oral experience so that they understand that I'm supposed to be eating through my mouth, and even though I'm eating through the tube, I'm still getting something in the mouth.
Okay, and I guess also to keep that sucking reflex, like you say, going all the time, so that they don't forget. Okay.
Okay. Then the disadvantages. So sometimes babies become very reliant on the dummies. It's often very difficult to transition them then from taking away the dummy. It often becomes very, very difficult for parents to, stop the kids from actually using the dummy. It can cause dental problems. So long-term use or using the dummy after the child has permanent teeth, which is usually past 4 or 5 years old, they can have dental issues such as misalignment of the teeth. It causes an increased risk of middle ear infections. That is because of the anatomy of a child compared to that of an adult, because the child's anatomy is a lot more different, so they're a lot more susceptible to infections compared to an adult. Then it can cause swallowing difficulties, so it may lead to delayed swallow development, and then I said dependency, and then a negative social impact. So the older a child gets, the more difficult it may be to socialize with the peers if they constantly have the dummy in their mouth. So there are advantages and there are disadvantages. I think it's just about balance.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it comes in.
I guess it's just knowing when to take the baby off the dummy again.
Okay. It's okay to use it as a sleep aid, like I said. So
yeah.
If they maybe, you know, fussy baby crying and you're trying to calm them down, then you can use it. But you don't want to put the dummy in their mouth constantly, so you don't just leave it in the mouth where the child is not even getting a chance to interact with other people. They're not talking because they're just laying there with the dummy.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We still have quite a bit to talk about. Maybe we'll do that in our next program. We can continue with this program. And Teresa won't be joining us, I believe, for the next few months.
Yes.
But we do wish you all the best, inshallah, and we hope to see you around about
September, inshallah.
Trish Kendall, you'll be back with us next month.
Yes.
And hopefully we'll continue with this program. And if you have anything else that we can add on to it, we'll be great. But thank you so much. It was wonderful talking to you guys. And until next time, assalamu alaikum. Oh, just before we stop, those contact details again, please.
Oh, okay.
Yes,
So the contact details for the clinic, you can contact us on 078-906-5308. So it is a cell phone number. Unfortunately, we don't have a landline. Also, because we don't have a receptionist at the clinic, if you phone us, you might not get through to us. So please send us an SMS. Send us an SMS with your name and what you need, and one of the staff members will SMS you back.
Well, thank you so much. That's the number. Until next time, from the 3-4 of us, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.